Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about radioactive fallout elements. For some reason, in the nice cozy armchair periodic table that you tell the kids, we don't say that there is two elements, which is einsteinium and fermium, after Albert Einstein and Enrico Fermi, people who were, well, I suppose, not central but inspirational to the Manhattan Project, had these elements named after them, and they were freely given to the whole world in the southern and northern hemisphere in nuclear tests. As people were going through, they were sifting through the radioactive fallout and found these two elements. And so this is one of the things that in all that difficulty, you know, all that struggle, and, you know, little scientists in Victorian era labs with test tubes looking up and doing heroic procedures, sometimes 300, I think 15,000 times was the maximum time for, rubidium, just going through it. So this is something which it's sort of a different story. So you have the story that I was looking at last episode, which was the lanthanides. And I was trying to point out something to you, that the lanthanides, if you look at the boiling temperature of the lanthanides, so lanthanum goes up to officially, for me, from a quantum physicist's point of viewpoint, there's only 14 elements in the F block, filtering elements across, and there's two periods, period 6 and 7. So the top one goes from lanthanum to, ytterbium, at the very end. And those elements are all from the lanthanide, and they're all from one area of Sweden. So Sweden has a few stabs of naming it after the town. So they have four elements which they've named after a single term, which is yttrium, which is in period 5. Yttrium's in period 5. And then there's ytterbium, erbium, and terbium, all aiming to name the same little town. And then you've got thulmium, scandium to name Sweden, europium to name Europe. It's, you know, just to make sure you're a bit uncertain. There's a few other. There's holmium, all just to say, look, this end of this periodic table is Sweden over and over and over. I was just trying to think, there may be another. And the wild child in there of all this place name one is Dripopsin. I can't pronounce it, perhaps. I've never heard it spoken, so it's the worst case. And so I thought, well, I've got a general picture to that. And the general picture, if you can imagine, you may have a book, and which the book's open, and it, if you look at the contour of the page, it goes up, goes down the spine where it's actually hooked into the spine of the book, and then the next pages go along. This is what happens to the trend in the periodic table. Everyone's got famous trends left to right. The actual trends in the D block, in fact, almost all blocks, and I call them subtables. The D subtable is, it goes up and drops that down at manganese, and then increases again at iron, and then drops down again as you go to zinc, in terms of the melting temperature. And the same thing happens in the lanthanides, except elements, there's 10 transition elements, and there's 14 F-block elements, and so the actual dip in the lowest melting temperature, which is europium, and the D-block, it's molybdenum. Well, and there is the same quantum chemistry. The quantum mechanics is the same driving it all. This is not the general simple story where we say this is broad trends, and so people have a trend of, in the old, I think it was Marx Brothers movies, they'd have someone saying, look, I've got this plant for sale. Does anyone have this plant? And every time he walks in, the plant's a little bit bigger. And so you you get this view, you know, the expectation, the gag. So it's sort of like the periodic table as a gag story. It starts off small, here's the big one, here's the missing one. I wonder what that's going to be. Oh, it'll be the mix between them. But it's actually a bit more sophisticated than that. And that's, for me, it really speaks of the issues that we have in the periodic table in terms of we've got a legacy of, what is it? Alchemy. And people spruiking the periodic table, wanting to own the periodic table, and when they do so, they want to tell you a fact with the guarantee that there's no more. And of course, it then breeds a group of people who believe certain facts and believe no more. And this is probably a whole class in society. They believe what the government tells them, what the newspaper says, and then very strictly, immediately after that, no more. We sort of train people to believe no more after it. But yeah, you've got the D and the F block. Now, the underneath the F block, you've got the actinites, and that goes from all the way up. It's not lawrencium. It's a lawrencium I place in this as a transition metal, but lawrencium's at the end of the actinide series, starting off with actinium, thorium, which is again, I think, a Swedish, you know, after the Thor, then pro-actinium, because they couldn't, the person mucked up the name, and so they said, well, you just have to name it that. And sort of there's a sort of a name muck up, and then eventually they had a big struggle to produce uranium. From the uranium, they produce plutonium, so they did a bit of periodic table magic to produce a new element, which is not in the ground. So there's no plutonium mines about the place. There's only uranium mines and rogue states, which get a whole lot of uranium together and turn it into plutonium, which turns it into a bomb. So the basic structure of it is that uranium's got a critical mass of around 60 kilograms, whereas plutonium is around 4 kilograms. You wrap that with neutron reflectors. I'm beginning to understand this a bit more. This is so the neutrons, rather than just bouncing out, it's sort of like putting it in a sort of reflective cavity. So the neutrons go, bounce back in, so you can reduce your critical mass. So they had a critical mass of about 6.4 kilograms of plutonium doing Nagasaki, and 64 kilograms-ish, it might have been 68 kilograms doing Hiroshima uranium across. So obviously, in terms of nuclear weapons, you want a smaller critical mass going up there with a bit more punch, so you need plutonium in your ballistic weapons, and the US had produced that. And so this is the romantic stage of the periodic table. But then you sort of scratch your head, saying, "Oh, this is sort of like a toxic end." Well, it is a toxic. It's a radioactively toxic end of the periodic table. But you also say, americium. It's used in a very small. It's used in smoke detectors and." It's an alpha particle source. I don't think there's many gamma rays, so it's sort of a nice sort of passive one that you can put into everybody's home. Homes is a radioactive source to save us from fire. Now, what's happened is that I think we found better ways of detecting fire than having a radioactive source in our homes, and that was really sort of an atomic age invention coming out. And I think we now have ionization detectors or actual physical smoke detectors. And so the age of americium is going down. Then there's curium, which is, so it goes, I think, plutonium, americium, curium. And after... So curium is something which you can make bucks of. It's got stability of, you know, some of it has thousands of years, and it's got a bit of a head scratcher, but it is sort of this ideal radiation source, X-ray radiation source. So you can put it in Martian landers, and they've got a little X-ray lab, you know, just a mobile phone size X-ray lab. it's pretty cool. Pretty cool how that is there. But also, it's sort of like the major component of nuclear waste, because a lot of it gets just produced for free in your domestic nuclear reactor. So yeah, it's a bit of a head scratcher about how to actually get around that. There's Berkeley, which I really don't know, but it's named after this place. I think it's in the suburbs of San Francisco, because I remember going out to visit Berkeley at one stage, and sort of remember the hotels and going out to visit Berkeley, and I do remember walking down the street, and this student was sitting there, and she had a piece of cardboard out, and she was sitting on the ground, and there were people, I'm homeless, and she had just all this money, and she said, "Help me overthrow the US government." She was an American, obviously, and people were just throwing money at her. But that's my memory of Berkeley. So Berkeley had this thing, which is a cyclotron. So a cyclotron is something which I have to talk to you about, because I've got a few minutes to kill to get this up to the full length. A cyclotron is this fantastic thing that a charged particle accelerated in a magnetic field goes in a circle. And the reason it goes in a circle, magnetic field goes in a circle, is due to ultimately special relativity. And I say this because special relativity is frame dependent, and as the particle accelerates, the the accelerator it sees, length contracts. Okay, so length contracts, and so what you and I see as a current, it sees as a charge. And so as it sees a charge, and it's itself a charge, it's pulled towards it, proportional to the velocity. So the force on a charge is proportional to the size of its charge and the velocity. That's it. The magnetic field, the size of the charge and the velocity, that's it, the force on it. Now, the force when you go around a corner, it's proportional to the velocity squared divided by the radius. So you could go at fairly high speed over a large radius, but as you as you suddenly drop the radius in, you get that V squared effect. You get this, your face gets ripped off. If you've ever been in a car with teaching your kids, you'll be aware of that. And I tell my kids about this. Look for the third derivative of the of motion. That's an important thing to ensure that, so you don't get shaken around. And also the centripetal force. Let's watch out for the centripetal force. But no, they don't. They take you around the corner too quickly. So you've got these two things, V squared on R, and is proportional to the force. It's also QVB. Cancel two V's. And so for a track going around in this, this is a vacuum system with the particles going around, it's a bit of a story to it. It will do a circle. A circle proportional, the radius of the circle will be proportional to its velocity. And that's an interesting thing, is that if you double the size of the circle, the particle travels around that at double the velocity. So what it means is that if you start them off, you can imagine a racing track, and you put the fastest person on the outer track and the slowest person on the inner curved track. The inner person will reach the same point as the faster person. The time of travel in a synchrotron is constant, which is just as well, because you fire your particles off, they go around the top, and they're going around half a circle, and then after half a circle, there's a little bit of push. Sort of like suddenly you can huge wind behind them, and what happens is that there's a radio frequency set of plates which accelerate the particles around each time they do a cycle of the cyclotron. So the cyclotron is sort of this magic invention which has come out of the blackboards of physicists, and it accelerates particles around, and we use it today all the time. It's in hospitals, in big hospitals and labs. You just make your own radioisotopes. You get one particle, and you can actually smash it. It's called an atom smasher. So it's like a small mobile phone, not the mobile phone size, but in terms of the scale of CERN, it's definitely a mobile phone size atom smasher. And this was developed by the Americans in the 1930s in the US, in California. That's, for me, it's just, California is just, I just can't comprehend how quickly it has developed. So Australia's developed in 200 years, and California has developed in less, and it's bigger. It's the 13th biggest economy. It's just extraordinary what has happened there. And then if you take it back, it's even had less development time. So 1860s, it was just the Wild West. 1930s, it was the world leading place. Had 60 years, it's just it's incomprehensible. It just does my head in. And so the cyclotron radiation, which is this special a magnetic donut which is cut down across the donut and through the donut, and it's got this acceleration which sort of tricks the particles. So rather than being a long accelerating beam, you build this little tiny thing, and you just trick the elements into being accelerated, and then they're going incredibly fast, and then they hit so fast they smash into targets and make new stuff. And so in this they made californium, which I really want. There's berkelium, californium, americium, einsteinium, berkelium, and all these things. So it's, if this Swedish decided that they were going to try and name an element outer village, America sort of went sort of a bit overboard and named all the elements after anything that moved that was American. And I just want to stop. Californium is just a... I don't think it's made by a synchrotron. It's made by a neutron source. So essentially, it's, if you can imagine, a small kid, and you keep on feeding him lollies, and the lollies are neutrons. And so eventually, you can feed Californium so many neutrons. It's the world's best preferred neutron source. People need it, they have californium as a neutron source. If you need neutrons as on a harbour to protect yourself against ships and all this type of stuff, you have a piece of californium there, and the californium is now spitting out the neutrons. So you shove the neutrons in, and then the neutrons come out. It's like, it's a radioactive element which has got a neutron source. Yes. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.